On this episode of Practical Guidance Labor and Employment Series, we speak with attorney Anthony Onsidi. Tony is co-chair of the Labor and Employment Group for Proskauer Rose. He works out of their Los Angeles office. Tony represents employers and management in all aspects of labor relations and employment law. Today, we will be looking at the current status of arbitration claims in the United States. We'll discuss the pros and cons of arbitration from an L&E perspective and best practices for employers when rolling out arbitration programs. I'm your host, Kevin Hilton. I'm an attorney with LexisNexis. To learn more about LexisNexis Practical Guidance Research Solutions, visit Lexis.com. Lexis Practical Guidance gives you insights to support what you do. Tony, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with the Practical Guidance podcast today. I wonder if you'd start by just telling me a little bit about your practice.
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name is Anthony Onsidi, and I'm the co-chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Proskauer Rose, a law firm which has offices in a number of U.S. cities and around the world. I'm resident in our Los Angeles office, where I head up our labor and employment practice.
So what is the current status of arbitration of employment claims in the country?
Sure. It's actually very much evolving, because I think it has in recent years become not only a legal issue, but also a political issue to some extent. And up to this point, I think historically, it's usually been governed by state law almost exclusively, with the exception of the Federal Arbitration Act, which is a 100-year-old statute. But on the state level, most states in some form or another do allow arbitration, or at least have until recently. And you see arbitration agreements not only in the employment setting, but in many, many other commercial settings as well. Anybody who's gone to a dentist recently or went to a doctor, a hospital, any number of commercial transactions that people engage in on a daily basis, anything having to do with a loan or an interaction with a financial services provider, all of those entities, for the most part, and service providers, usually have some form of arbitration agreement that is placed somewhere in the mound of paperwork that we all get when we initiate that relationship. So having it in the employment context is not that different. Many employers have it as well. But I think because maybe people's jobs and their professions and so on are perhaps closer, nearer and dearer to their interests and their concerns, as well as the fact that there's a very well-formed plaintiff's bar that represents employees, means that the arbitration agreements that exist in the context of the employment relationship often tend to get scrutinized perhaps even more carefully than those arbitration agreements we see in other commercial aspects of the economy.
And what would you say are the advantages or disadvantages of arbitration for an employer versus the employee?
Well, you know, that's also kind of a moving target. I think traditionally, if I'd answered that question maybe 10 years ago, I would have said, well, arbitration tends to be a quicker and more efficient, less expensive means of resolving a dispute. So if an employee believes that they, for one reason or another, have been wrongfully treated or harassed or wrongfully terminated, whatever it may be, rather than have a lawsuit filed and having a jury and having all the discovery obligations that go along with civil discovery, the parties would engage in arbitration. And usually that would mean that you would get to resolution sooner, that there would be less discovery, meaning fewer depositions, fewer documents, fewer interrogatories, all the things that go along with litigation these days. And it was just a quicker way of getting things resolved. That's changed to some extent because, again, there's been so much scrutiny given with respect to arbitration agreements in the employment context that now most arbitration providers and even arbitrators themselves are much more concerned about making sure there is complete due process available to both parties, that you end up often having as much litigation and discovery in the arbitration that you used to have only in civil litigation. And so that, I think, has to some extent diminished part of the advantage of arbitration, because, as I say, it used to be a much more streamlined process. It was quicker. Now most arbitrators, as I say, will allow multiple depositions, multiple document requests, electronic discovery, all kinds of things that go along with civil litigation typically. And so I think there's less of an advantage from that perspective. But there still is an advantage to employers, I think, generally, with respect to having arbitration. And that is particularly in jurisdictions such as mine here in California, where juries have in recent years become much more hostile, I think, to employers and much more sympathetic to employees who claim that they have been wrongfully treated, wrongfully terminated, harassed, discriminated against, retaliated against. Right. And I think that being able to curb the enthusiasm, if you will, of some juries to enter very, very large verdicts, and we can talk about what I mean by that here in California, for example, in and of itself is an advantage to employers of the arbitration process.
Even though it has expanded, it still, to a certain extent, streamlines the cost of versus a full-blown litigation. And what you're saying right there is that the potential for massive and crazy outcomes seems to be less likely with when you're dealing with an arbitration decision.
Yes. So what I'm talking about, and this is, you know, fairly well publicized on our blog and here in California, right, as well as other places, in recent years, and particularly it seems since the pandemic, there's been a significant uptick, from my perspective at least, of large jury verdicts, single plaintiff jury verdicts. We're not talking about class actions, by the way. So whereas it used to be very unusual to have a jury verdict, say, in the mid seven figure range, that is 5 to 10 million, for example, for a single plaintiff, we're now recording here in California, especially in Los Angeles and San Francisco, jury verdicts that are in excess of $10 million. Yeah. And in fact, there have been some even more eye-popping verdicts in the recent past, including a couple in excess of $100 million for single plaintiff cases. There was a very notable and well-reported verdict against Tesla in a harassment case. It was not even a termination case. It was not a discrimination per se case. It was a racial harassment case where the employee had resigned. And the employee was given by the jury in that case, which was a San Francisco jury in federal court, $137 million. This was a short-term employee who admittedly did testify about very extreme racial harassment that he perceived in the workplace. And he did resign. But that $137 million verdict was composed primarily of emotional distress damages and punitive damages. Now, those numbers, when I talk about those kinds of amounts, people always ask, well, that can't stick. That obviously had to be reduced. And the answer to that is yes. Right. Most cases like that, including in that case, end up getting back before the judge after the trial's over, and the judge typically will reduce, or at least conditionally reduce the verdict and offer the plaintiff this reduced verdict or the choice of having a new trial. Almost always what happens in that situation is that an appeal gets filed by one or both parties because the employer still thinks the even reduced verdict is too high, right, and the plaintiff thinks that the reduced verdict is too low. And that has happened time and time again, including a $155 million verdict here in Los Angeles against an insurance company by an in-house lawyer who claimed that he was a whistleblower. That case was subject to post-trial motions, like I said, the other case was. And again, the judge had reduced that verdict substantially, but both sides have now since appealed. Just this week, the judge ordered over $2 million in attorney's fees to be awarded to the plaintiff's lawyer in that case. But as I say, it's all up on appeal, so it'll be a while before anybody pays any money, at least to the other side, in that particular case.
Got it. And so I guess one of the byproducts also of having an arbitration would have typically at least been that it was not only streamlined, I guess, in the process, but also in the time from claim to disposition.
Correct. And actually, it's, you know, it's actually almost a laboratory condition experiment against Tesla. I mentioned the $137 million verdict.
Right.
But in the very recent past, and actually very recent compared to that $137 million verdict, there was another African-American employee who sued Tesla, I believe in the same facility, who claimed that he too was the victim of race harassment. And that case was heard by an arbitrator and not by a jury.
Right.
And so you have almost identical conditions, obviously not the same plaintiff, but both claiming the same kinds of harassment against the same employer in the same location.
Wow.
And the verdict in the jury trial, as I said, was $137 million. The award from the arbitrator was $1 million. Which, when that came out, and that actually came out before the $137 million verdict, a lot of people thought that was a lot of money,
right?
Especially for an arbitrator to award. But you're talking about a ratio of 137-1.
Wow.
When you compare the jury verdict to the arbitration award. And that significance has not been lost on either plaintiff's counsel or defense counsel. So that means that most plaintiff's counsel now will, and not just because of this case, but just generally what's going on in these cases, will always prefer and will always fight, always prefer jury trials and will always fight arbitration agreements if and when they are presented. And that's become standard operating procedure. No matter when the arbitration agreement was signed, no matter when it was negotiated, no matter what it says, every plaintiff's lawyer, for the most part, will ignore it. And will file the case in court, even if the defense has notified or reminded, I guess is a better word, the plaintiff that they are subject to an arbitration agreement. What they typically do is they disregard the arbitration agreement, they file in court, and they wait for the defendant to then file a motion to compel arbitration in response to the civil action. And some judges grant those motions and some judges don't. You know, obviously, every arbitration agreement is different, and there are lots and lots and lots of cases that both sides can point to say, this is why the arbitration agreement shouldn't be enforced, and the defense, of course, can point to other cases saying this is why it should be enforced, and oftentimes it's just up to the discretion of the judge whether to enforce it or not. So that has become a very typical outcome now, even in the face of a recently filed, completely above board, non-overreaching arbitration agreement. Plaintiff's lawyers just ignore them.
Yeah, well, I could see why. The disparity between the two outcomes certainly would make it worth taking a swing at open court. So what would you say are some best practices for an employer to follow when they're rolling out an arbitration program?
Well, there are a lot of issues that immediately present themselves. And again, I'm not here to just say arbitration is always the best for every employer, because it may not be. Arbitration can be very expensive. What we haven't talked about are the costs of arbitration, and at least in California and in many other jurisdictions these days, the employer is required to pay 100% of the costs of the arbitration. So essentially, to the extent that they exceed what would be incurred by the employee in court. And that's basically everything other than the filing fees for the most part. So it's not a really significant amount of the cost that the employee has to pay.
Right.
but what will happen as soon as you file an arbitration or one is sent to arbitration by a court is the arbitration administration agency will send a bill to the employer for an advance against future arbitration fees that will be incurred or expect to be incurred in the case. And that bill itself can be $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 at the very outset sent to the employer. And a lot of employers, I think, view that as a cold splash of water, especially if they think that there's limited legitimacy to the case, which is often the situation. There are also disadvantages to arbitration. Few arbitrators grant summary judgment motions. I won't speculate as to why that is, but it is the case that it's a lot harder, or at least it's perceived to be a lot harder, to get an arbitrator to dispose of a case before an actual full-blown hearing than to get a judge to dismiss a case before a trial. And so if the case actually is susceptible to early resolution by a motion to dismiss or a demur or a motion for summary judgment, some employers actually aren't that inclined to want arbitration in those cases because they know that an arbitrator may be less likely to dismiss the case pre-hearing. So that's another disadvantage, I think, that some employers perceive. But I think on balance, having looked at many, many, many cases like this, employers are better off with having an arbitration agreement in place than not. Because, you know, what we do know is that 70 to 80 to 90% of these cases end up getting settled. And they often get settled in a mediation context. And I can tell you from real world experience that if there's an enforceable arbitration agreement in place, that's something obviously the employer should be noting and pointing out to the mediator, who will then usually have a fairly subtle but noticeable smile on his or her face when they go into the other room and say, you're never going to get a big judgment in this case. Right. You're never going to hit a home run. You're never going to get, even if you win everything, more than X, which will primarily probably be lost wages, maybe future and past lost wages, and maybe some emotional distress, but not a huge amount, and maybe some punitive damages, but not a huge amount. And so that gives the employer huge amounts of leverage to settle the case that they won't have if there's no arbitration in place. So like I say, I talk to employers about this every day, often all day, and many of them say, well, gee, most of our cases settle anyway, so I don't think we need it. I think especially for cases that settle, having an arbitration agreement in place that you've not yet had to use, but that is binding upon the employee who is making these claims is extremely helpful and can significantly diminish the cost of settling a case that may never even have been filed.
Right. Mitigates the potential outcome way before
you have to start and negotiating. And most arbitration agreements these days also have, because they're permitted to have, class action waiver provisions in them, which again is something very valuable to employers. Unless you've got a standalone class action waiver, it's always a good idea to put that in an arbitration agreement. And now, as a result of the Viking River case that came out in June of this past year from the U.S. Supreme Court, you can even waive some PAGA claims, Private Attorney General Act claims in California, which up to that point had not been waivable and had not been subject to arbitration.
So these decisions are binding. Are there appellate options if someone is dissatisfied?
Yeah, I believe if the motion to compel arbitration is granted by the court, I believe that the plaintiff who's opposing the motion can seek appellate intervention, at least in California, immediate appellate intervention, but the likelihood, I think, of that being granted is fairly small. On the other hand, if it is denied, I believe that an employer can appeal that, at least in some jurisdictions. So it's sort of an immediate writ intervention by the plaintiff or an immediate appeal, I believe, by the defendant. And again, that's going to differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But yes, appellate intervention can be sought in both instances and often is. And I think some employers take the position in negotiating with the plaintiff that, gee, I know you're going to oppose our motion to compel arbitration, but if we lose that, we're simply going to file an appeal. And in big jurisdictions like California or New York or Illinois, that could be another 2 or 3 years down the road that you get a resolution of that appeal. So again, that's not something that most plaintiff's lawyers want to walk into. They'd rather get something done quickly and without that kind of delay.
So for a lot of reasons, it seems like an arbitration agreement, an arbitration clause is going to be a highly preferable for an employer to have at this point.
Correct. And you asked me generally, you know, what are some of the best practices? Another thing to keep in mind, I think, when you're rolling one of these out or thinking about rolling them out is obviously go through the checklist of pros and cons. And there are pros and cons to having it, and there are pros and cons to not having it. But there also, you know, are some things you're going to have to make some decisions about, because some employees increasingly are very sophisticated on this issue, and a couple of Google searches will make them sophisticated if they aren't already. And they may say, I don't want to sign it. And then the question is, what do you do then? Do you terminate an employee, an existing employee? Let's talk about them first, who refuses to sign it. Some employers have gone that route. That's not typically the advice I give. So you may have some people who just refuse to sign it. Other employers, rather than using a stick, use a carrot, and they say, sign this arbitration agreement and you'll get $1,000 bonus.
Right.
Some combination of the two. You'll get a bonus, or you won't get bonuses going forward, or you won't get promotions going forward if you don't sign it. So those are all kinds of things that employers can think about and decide. The easier group of individuals it's used for are typically applicants. So somebody who isn't a current employee, but who is now just applying to be an employee. I think with respect to applicants, at the very least, employers should consider putting arbitration agreements in place, because at that point, the applicant, if they are this sophisticated or hostile to arbitration agreements, they can say, gee, I don't want to work at a place that has arbitration agreements, so I won't apply to work at your place of employment. I always say in response to that, that if you've got an employee who's primary motivation is that when they finally decide to sue you in a year or two, that they want to have the jurisdiction that will most likely lead to a multi-million dollar judgment in their favor, I'm not sure that's the best kind of employee you should be looking for. There might be other more appealing employees who would be somebody you'd want to hire.
Tony, thank you again so much for your time and all the insight you've provided today. To learn more about Tony's practice at Proskauer, visit the firm's website at proskauer.com. As a note, if you're enjoying these podcasts, please subscribe or follow the monthly Labor and Employment Practice Area series you're listening to right now. Lexis is also offering a monthly practice-specific data privacy podcast, a rotating practice area series, and we're launching an investment management series in the coming months. All of these practical guidance podcasts can be found through your favorite podcast provider. And remember, no matter your practice area, if you need practical guidance on how to proceed in your work, check out Lexis' Practical Guidance Research Solution, available now through Lexis. For more information, visit lexis.com. Thanks, and be well.